Hello and welcome to the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Today, I'm going to be talking about some tech myths. So, problems that we expect technology to sort of solve for us, but which technology actually won't solve for us, in my opinion. First, a couple of just show notes things. A couple of people mentioned that there was some buzzing noise in my last couple episodes, and I'm doing my best to fix that by just, you know, I don't have a studio or anything, so I'm just kind of setting up a weird setup to try to reduce the amount of noise in the room. So let me know how that is. Other than that, hopefully everything is going okay and it's at least listenable, but please let me know. You know, I do a lot of different kinds of art creation, crafts. I write and I, you know, I do video editing and those kind of things. And obviously I do game design. But I actually went to school, to college for music composition. And I composed some of the music for our games at Dino Farm Games. And, you know, I've written music for pop groups and my own bands and some other podcasts and things like that. But, you know, I have a decent amount of experience with music composition. And in addition to that, actually my day job is, weirdly enough, is doing pixel art for other indie games, small indie games. And my other day job is teaching animation, 2D animation, to kids and teenagers at a nearby art center. So my point is that I kind of have my fingers in a lot of sort of creative pies, I guess you could say. And something that does come up in these fields is people try to kind of come up with shortcuts. People try to figure out ways that they can make their job easier. And I mean, that's, you know, that's smart. That's what the humans do. It's like totally natural to try to find the most conservative way to get what you need to get done. That's totally natural, and I don't fault people at all, and I'm looking for the same thing. But, and there are shortcuts. Shortcuts do exist, but they're not easy shortcuts. It's kind of hard to explain, but like the shortcuts are kind of tend to have a lot of, the real shortcuts tend to have a lot of upfront investment and tend to not show you the results right away. So what people want is, you know, they can just buy some thing, some tool, some piece of technology, and then everything will be easy. Or there's some computer program that they can just, like, you know, plug stuff in and then boom, great song, great Photoshop painting. People want things to be easy in that way. And you know, it's a reasonable thing to want, but it's never the case. It never works that way. The real way to make things easier is very frustratingly just to kind of study fundamentals up front, to plan, to do a lot of things that, you know, we all know we should do, but we kind of don't do a lot of the time. That's really the only shortcut, is to kind of plan and to do all the stuff that we sort of know that we should be doing. So, for example, if you're writing a story, there's no shortcut really to writing a great story. The shortcut really is, you know, like coming up with a strong controlling idea early and building a good plot outline and reviewing your plot outline many times before just diving into writing. You know, a lot of people will write and they'll just kind of like write half the book or half the story or whatever, and then realize that they have, you know, actual problems with the spine of the piece. The actual, you know, functionality of it is broken because the actual, you know, plot arcs don't work. So, you know, in that case, that's a good example for, I think, why planning is important. And planning is like the real deal. in terms of actually saving you time. But it doesn't feel that way sometimes because it takes a lot of time up front to do it. And so my point here is just to say that there aren't really shortcuts in the way that we always hope that there will be. Most of the shortcuts are just sort of annoying things that we want to avoid having to do. Now, technology, I should also say, obviously technology makes everything easier. Having computers, having the ability to hit undo in Photoshop, having the ability to just scoot little pieces around, you know, in video editors, as opposed to what you used to have to do, which was actually like splice film and using like a like an actual razor and cut it and then tape pieces of film together. You know, obviously computers make everything easier. And that continues to be more and more the case. Now we can get feedback faster than ever. I mean, I'm putting these podcasts together and I can sort of immediately get feedback from people like within an hour. That would never have been the case before computers. So, you know, when I talk about tech myths, I'm not saying that technology in general is like a myth, or that computers and other kinds of technology that we don't even have right now might really revolutionize the way that we do stuff. However, I do think there's a few avenues in technology that we in game design tend to look to as maybe the future and things that are very exciting, which most people think are very exciting, but I don't think are exciting. And I think that's because of some misunderstandings around them. So the first one I'll get into is the idea of AI in game design, artificial intelligence. So typical AI in video games as we know it is a set of instructions. It's, you know, if this, then this. You know, usually you'll have like a tree of like possible behavior routes. Like, I'm just trying to think like what would be a good example. Maybe StarCraft AI, for example. The, you know, in the single player or when you're playing against a bot. The AI has some build order instructions, things that it's supposed to do, like pretty much every game. It may have some randomization in terms of whether it's going for this kind of unit or that kind of unit, you know, more of a barracks build or more of a factory build or something. But pretty much it just has like a list of things to do. And then it basically just has if-then statements for the player, for the player's actions. So the player does this, then I do this. If the player does this, then I do this. For example, if you bring a Zergling into their SCV line, they have their SCVs attack the Zergling. And you know, you can actually even exploit the at least the original StarCraft AI pretty hard by bringing just one Zergling into the enemy line of SCVs and just hitting them once and then running, and they'll just chase their entire economy will just chase you across the map trying to chase down that one Zergling. So that's a good example of, I mean, that's, you know, you might just say, oh, well, that's just bad AI. That's just sloppy AI. And yeah, that's fine. I agree. But so if we look at like what that information is, the AI, in this case, in the cases of most AI that we actually deal with on a day-to-day basis in games, they're just a set of instructions. They're just a list of if-thens. And, you know, sometimes they get pretty complicated. For the most part, they're not too complicated. But here's the thing that I think people don't really get, is that in single-player games, if there is a, let's say there's like a strategy game, and then there's an AI, like sort of laid on top of that, right? So you have this like list of AI, to, you know, if-thens on top of the strategy game. What happens is that the player really doesn't have to master the game. They really only have to master the enemy AI, as, you know, that example of making SCVs chase you all the way across the map. That's like a really, really harsh example, like a very, very strong example. But much subtler examples happen all the time. And they almost, we kind of almost do it like without even thinking about it. People who have been playing video games their whole lives we just know that like what we're trying to do is really just exploit the AI. And the reason is that basically what you've done is you've laid this puzzle, this very, very simple, actually, puzzle on top of the game. And, you know, you can make massive, you know, resource shifts and power shifts in the game state by changing the puzzle, by mastering the puzzle. And so, you know, that's why I advocate for, and here's another game design guideline, very, very simple AI. If you have AI at all, it should almost not even be like AI. It should just be like one instruction or something. Stuff that, or two instructions. Basically, things that players immediately solve. And the reason for that is, if I haven't made it clear already, you know, you want the system to be what people are solving. And if you have a complicated AI structure, it could be like players could play and sort of seem like they don't have your system solved. But in fact, once they solve that AI puzzle on top of the game, then they do just then you're then we're relying on your game to sort of survive that. And we don't really know if your game hasn't really been tested to see if that's actually something it can survive. You know, what we want is very simple AI so that we can see through it immediately and we can actually start testing the depth of your game. And this brings me to, I'm not finished explaining that, by the way. If that's not clear so far, just stick with me for a second, because we're talking about now slightly more complicated AIs. So like, you know, AI that is pretty complex. And to talk about that, I think one thing we got to talk about is the idea of the opponent as a black box. You never know what the opponent's going to do. Now, you may have a sort of, you might know your opponent really well, and you know that he generally, you know, likes to do rush attacks or rush down, you know, openings, or he really likes this one, he prefers this one piece in chess, and you know he's good with knights. So you may know all these pieces of information about a player, but ultimately you don't know what they're going to do. The actual move turn to turn that comes out of them is for you random, effectively random, in the sense that, you know, anything can be random. It's not truly random, but I mean, nothing's truly random. It's, you know, nothing that we deal with. Someone might be like saying, oh, but what about quantum whatever? Okay, fine. Quantum is random. Now, anyway, back to like the actual, you know, stuff we actually deal with on a day-to-day basis. And in that world, in our world, in our non-quantum world, nothing's random. So, you know, I think people try to use quantum stuff as this like get out of functional conversation free card. But either way, my point is, you have no idea. You don't know what an opponent is going to do. You may have the ability to guess what they're going to do slightly higher than, you know, 50, 60, 70% of the time. But you could feel very certain that you know that the player is going to do this on the next turn and then they just don't. So it's effectively random. And that's something that I think people don't really get. There's a lot of mythology about reads, about how like, oh, you know, people are very good at remembering the hits, at sort of confirmation bias. And so they'll be like, oh, I totally knew. A game that I can't help but bring up is David Sirlin's Yomi, which is kind of like a much more, it takes rock, paper, scissors and tries to make it into like a fighting card game. That's basically what it is. And what's interesting about it is that it's, you know, ultimately it kind of does come down to rock, paper, scissors, but because it has all this other stuff going on, people start really kind of taking it very seriously. And so we've actually gotten into some really big, huge debates over at the Dino Farm forums, which, by the way, I recommend people come by. about rock, paper, scissors, and about reading, and about how much you can ever really know what an opponent's going to do. And what people will do is, so there's a, you know, let's just go back to rock, paper, scissors for a second. You can feel like, okay, let's say he's played rock three times and I feel really confident. I just know this time he's going to play paper. And you feel that, right? You're like super certain, for whatever reason, you just have this feeling that he's going to play paper. And so you play scissors, he plays paper, and you win. You were right. But here's the thing, though. How do you know you didn't just get lucky? You know, people tend to ascribe agency to those kinds of random events. And to me, it looks a lot like seeing Jesus in toast, or seeing shapes in the clouds, or just seeing patterns where there are none. And, you know, we're very good at forgetting all those times when we thought they were going to do something and they didn't do it. But we're very good at remembering the times when we thought they would do something, but they would do it. That's just a little bit of a side thing. But the point is that, you know, a player's choices, what players do, is kind of a black box. It is kind of random. Now, I should mention that really quickly, since I'm saying that player input, you know, an opponent's input is random, that doesn't mean that I think all games should be single player. What it does mean is that I think all games should have a healthy information horizon. So the distance between when I put information into the game and when it affects the other player has to be decent enough so that the other player can do something about it. And so that's my big problem with rock, paper, scissors, is because, you know, a player plays rock and I already played scissor. I mean, I can't respond to that information at all. I have literally zero time to respond to the information that just came into the game. I had to have guessed beforehand. So, if you watch my 3-minute game design episode on randomness, I think I go into a little more detail about why you want that information horizon to be at a healthy level. I also wrote an article, on my site called, Uncapped Look Ahead and the Information Horizon, which I recommend reading. It talks a little bit about setting a good, information horizon so that you get input randomness rather than output randomness. An opponent is a black box. They're a source of randomness. And that's something we can use in games, but like I said, there has to be a healthy information horizon. Now, going back to AI, so we've talked about very simple AI. So, and a slightly more complex AI, what I advocate is the simplest AI possible. In my game Oro, monsters just walk right towards you. They just walk at you and you try to do their ability. There's a couple monsters who have the opposite. They try to avoid you or they stay still, but it's always a very, very, very simple set of instructions. And, you know, actually where possible, I would like to make it even simpler going forward. And if people have suggestions for that, please feel free to share those with me. Now, getting into, you know, like human level AI, basically like true AI that seems like an intelligence, right? That kind of an AI for game designers is basically just a person. It's, you know, it's effectively a person. It has the advantage of you can play against it as much as you want, but we kind of already have that in terms of like online games and matchmaking. You know, you can kind of play against people in chess any hour of any day for as long as you want. There's some minor advantages, like you can play against the same AI or whatever for as long as you want, the same person. They'll never get tired of playing against you, I suppose. Although if they're a human level AI, perhaps they would. I don't know. Either way, my point is a human level, you know, AI doesn't help us because it's just a black box. It's just a source of randomness, basically. If it's like a human, it's just a source of randomness. It's exactly the same as a human opponent. So that really just doesn't help us at all in terms of game design. other than sort of like practical, you know, oh, you can play against them as much as you want type of stuff. And then I guess I could quickly mention a superhuman AI, an AI that would be, you know, much smarter than a human being. And, you know, they might be good for game design in that they come up with just better game designs themselves. They just, you know, any creature that's smarter and better than us would make better games than we would. And I suppose there's a question about whether humans would be able to even kind of appreciate how good those games would be. They may be above our comprehension in the way that, you know, I don't know, Puerto Rico or some serious strategy game is above the comprehension of a five-year-old. But we could probably learn some stuff from it and start sort of piecing stuff together. And, you know, it would be a good thing for game design if we had superhuman intelligence, but it would be a good thing for literally every single field if we had superhuman intelligence. So it's kind of, it's sort of moot. It's not something we specifically need to look forward to. So ultimately, AI, there's kind of a lot of mythology about that. You know, people misunderstand, people think, and this will take me into my next point, but people sort of think that that AI will revolutionize game design. I don't think that's the case. I think actually we need to make AI as simple as possible to the point where it doesn't even look like AI anymore. Now, of course, if we're talking about fantasy simulators, if we're talking about like, you know, D&D, I can see how a human level AI would be very useful in those scenarios. You always have a DM, you always have these other characters that are like basically human beings. And that could be really cool for fantasy simulators. So I'll definitely give points there, but like I say, this is, we're talking about strategy games, and for strategy games, simple AI is the way to go. And talking about mentioning, fantasy simulators, the next point, the next, kind of tech myth I want to talk about is immersion, the concept of immersion. So people tend to, people talk about immersion a lot. Actually, interestingly, in the last couple years, I would say people have sort of stopped talking about it a little bit, which is pretty cool. That's good. Right now we have other, the gimmick sphere has shifted over to sort of social issue games, art games, and personal games and things like that. Right now, and I'm not saying that those are entirely gimmicks. As I mentioned in the first episode, I think those things are important. I think we do need some kind of, we need to like invite, you know, the rest of the population into the world of interactive systems. And I think that if those things can do that, that is a good thing. But in terms of, you know, pursuing the discipline of building interactive rule sets, I think it's off topic, sort of. It's like not, it's not, it's doesn't hurt us, but it doesn't help us. So going back to this immersion concept, which, you know, seems to have fallen out of favor a little bit, but I think still is there in the AAA games. And is certainly, if people aren't talking about it, it's still the predominating sort of idea behind why AAA games are the way they are, which are these giant, huge budget, you know, technological spectacles with huge, you know, over maps, and you're running around, and a lot of times they're first person or third person. And the whole concept is like, oh, it's immersive. It feels like you're really there. And, you know, I'm not against immersion. Actually, I think that great games are immersive. However, I don't think immersion comes from audiovisual stimulus. I think immersion comes from engagement, you know, and I think this is something that some others have talked about before, but, you know, the things that make you, I've been as immersed in anything as I have been in when I'm playing Tetris and things are going crazy fast and, you know, I'm extremely engaged, or if I'm in a very serious match of Go, and I mean, that's just total pure immersion, or playing tennis. I mean, I suppose tennis is a weird example because you're, yeah, I guess you could argue you have the audiovisual feedback there, but let's stick with Go and Tetris. Two things that I think are extremely experience consuming. You know, like they completely take up your vision on and your thinking. And so I think that the idea, you know, so you can have this. I think I often use the Elder Scrolls series. The last one I really played a lot was, well, sort of a lot, was Oblivion, the fourth one. And, you know, that was at the time heralded as highly immersive, largely because it had, you know, the best graphics, sort of like graphics in the AAA sense of the word, with, you know, very nice looking programmer water and programmer trees, and everything looked all nice and, you know, fancy and cutting edge in terms of tech, which is basically what people look for. And but yeah, that game is a great example, because actually there were so many things in it that even for a fantasy simulator RPG thing just really take you out of the experience. I mean, the persuasion system, which was like bizarre, this weird little mini game you had to play that was like actually kind of abstract and strange, or just like weird little things like the way characters spoke to each other, or the big green arrow that told you where to go on your map, or the fact that you could just kind of like, there was just so many things. Yeah, I don't remember all as many specifics as I probably used to, but the point is there's a lot of rules in Oblivion that actually make it less immersive than it otherwise would be, despite the visual aspect. And it's also just really funny that the idea that I guess most AAA people must have, which is that, you know, something being cutting edge tech makes it immersive. But then 5 to 10 years later, that tech looks all old, and so now it's not immersive. You know what I mean? Like, so that's just a very strange thing. I mean, the point is, I think what that kind of immersion actually is really just technological spectacle. You walk around a little bit, and you're like, wow, cool. The graphics are better than last year's games. I think that's actually what people are experiencing, not immersion. And they're sort of confusing with that with immersion. People don't like the idea of they're just being wowed by pretty graphics or basically new technology. So yeah, the immersion thing is kind of a big myth. And that leads into maybe the king of tech myths. And that is virtual reality. And I mentioned this a little bit in the last episode. But yeah, I think virtual reality is, in terms of game design and in terms of interactive entertainment, largely a myth. Like, it's largely not what people expect that it's going to be. So I think what people expect is there's going to be virtual reality, and then, you know, like let's take the Matrix as the, you know, that's like the perfect virtual reality that's completely indistinguishable from real life. And I think what they kind of think is, well, you can just do all this crazy stuff. You can, you know, live out your fantasies. Whatever your fantasies are, you can actually live them in virtual reality. And, you know, that's true. But the problem is, and this is a large point that's going to take probably a good amount of convincing, I think, for some people, but our fantasies aren't as good as we think they are. Human beings are extremely smart, and we solve things very quickly. One of the reasons that, you know, human adults don't play with toys that much is because they, even if it's kind of a complex toy, we can kind of just figure it out. Like, we play with whatever toy it is for a few minutes, and we're just like, okay, yeah, I get it, you know? They might even literally say, I get it. And the thing is, we're so smart that we can just like map out, we just understand everything that would be possible pretty much with this toy. That same principle applies to a lot of stuff. There's a reason that human adults gravitate towards heavily designed formal experiences. What are the things that bring adults the most value, really? They are things like novels and things like movies and things like music and things like strategy games. And, you know, all these forms which are very, very carefully constructed to produce value. So I should mention that virtual reality, when we have the Matrix kind of virtual reality, there's going to be a ton of applications for that. I think that's going to be extremely useful, and I would even say that it'll revolutionize a lot about how we all live. You know, how we learn, how we do many, many things. I think it's going to be massive for the world. But for interactive entertainment, I think it's just going to be actually pretty small. I have an idea for a comic that I've been wanting to make for a while, and I haven't gotten around to it, partially because I don't know exactly how to deliver it. But the basic concept is, so you have the first panel, and you have two people, and the person one is like sitting there trying to design a board game, and he's like tinkering around with like cards and paper and stuff. And person two comes up to him and he's like, "Hey dude, I just got this new virtual reality machine. You want to come check it out? It's awesome." And so then he's like, "Oh yeah, awesome, definitely." And then they go and they kind of like go into the virtual reality and they're like doing stuff and whatever. And then it cuts to, I don't know, like a few days later or the next day, and they're in the virtual reality world designing a board game. So the idea behind the joke there is like, okay, cool, you have this fantasy world and it's not the real world. Now what are you going to do? And that's what I was saying last time. So I think people think, well, you know, I'm going to ride a jet ski and I'm going to jump off cliffs and I'm going to like have sex with all these people that I've always wanted to and fight a dragon and just whatever your fantasy is, you know, no matter what it is. But the thing is, all of those things, like they're not heavily designed experiences. And so, you know, I hate to say this, but your brain's just going to kind of solve them and you're going to get bored of them like pretty quickly, no matter what they are. So, I mean, ultimately you're going to come down to this question of like, what do you do in that system? And I'm reminded that recently there was an article or something about someone found a way to watch Netflix in the Oculus Rift. So that kind of just says it all to me. I'll try to link that in the show notes because, you know, it almost sounds like to me like an Onion article or something, because it's just so poetically perfect in explaining the problem. You know, if I was in a virtual reality world, I would probably want to watch Netflix. I would probably want to go design a board game. I'd probably want to read Wikipedia and, you know, do the kinds of things that actually provide value for people, for adults. And now, again, I need to temper that a little bit because there are probably applications. You know, like I just said, read Wikipedia, and it's like, oh, okay, you're going to like read the article about the Civil War or whatever. Well, now with virtual reality, you can actually kind of, I don't know, go experience the Civil War, or like at least walk through some kind of, you know, kind of like walking through a museum, but you can just do it from home. And there are certainly going to be applications like that, and that's very exciting. But again, just talking about interactive entertainment, the virtual reality is mostly a myth. It's not going to do much for us. Now, one last thing I will say about virtual reality is, you know, maybe there are some strategy games or some other forms that we can really embrace in that, using that. I'm certainly not saying that someone can't make a great strategy game using virtual reality. I think that absolutely they can. I mean, for you could have always just designed a board game in virtual reality, of course. But, you know, you could embrace the first person nature somehow and make a great strategy game. I'm sure that's possible. But I'm just saying that it doesn't really help us. It doesn't. It's not a significant step forward for game design or for interactive entertainment design in general. So that's a big thing that I hope that I can get across to people. And I'm not sure that I will have convinced everyone with this explanation. I should probably write an article about that. I did write the article "Toys in the Adult Mind," which kind of addresses this a little bit. And basically just the idea that humans are smart, adult humans, we solve stuff very quickly. And so we need actual forms that deliver value very carefully in the ways that strategy games and books and, you know, stories, these forms that bring real serious value and are difficult to solve and are interesting. Those are really the only ways that we can really deliver value to people. So yeah, to wrap up, I would just like to say again that we often look to these kinds of tech gimmicks. And, you know, another thing I have mentioned before, things like the Wiimote and the Power Glove, and which is kind of the same thing. And, you know, weird input devices and all this stuff. It's kind of in the same category as tech myths. But I think we shouldn't be looking to technology for our answers. We should be looking to philosophy. Basically, we should be looking to critical thinking and really looking at what we've done already that works. We should be looking heavily at board game designs. I think the world of board games, not because they're board games, but for whatever cultural reasons, they actually have been making progress on problems of game design, real problems of game design. And we should also look at progress that's been made in video games. You know, I this is probably a whole topic, but you know, I think that the change from RTSs to the Dota-like things, I think we got to really look at like what exactly is happening there that's making that's taking the RTS thing model out of favor and the Dota likes into favor. And I certainly have some opinions on that, but I'll save those for another time. So yeah, there's no shortcuts to making great things. Making great things is hard, and because humans are smart, precisely because humans are so smart, and they'll solve whatever it is you make faster than you can believe. So, you know, that's why we need to make these like carefully balanced, like little machines that produce value. And it's very hard, but we've learned a little bit about how to do that in other mediums, and we're going to learn how to do that in interactive systems as time goes on. As long as we keep our minds focused on that problem rather than being distracted by other shinier things, I think that will increase the speed at which we learn to make better systems faster. And so I'm excited to see that happen. And with that, I'll say thank you for listening, and please do let me know if the show sounds better, and let me know what you think in general of the podcast. Thank you so much. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a patron by going to www.patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Thanks for listening.